I have to say that today is October 16th, 2014, and it's Karen Brewster and Dave Klein, and we're continuing on your international work, and you were going to talk about Greenland, and I guess Iceland blends into that.
And a lot of this international work, we talked about the Fulbright program, and that, of course, was stimulated that. But also one of the reasons why I was able to work internationally as much as I did was because our program here was developing well on my work and Bob White's work with my work with Caribou, and then Jack Lewick and Bob White working together and his students on physiology. And then we mentioned, I think, the radioactive fallout and the studies that Jack Lewick was doing. Well, we were the organizers of UF people that were working with Caribou mostly, but also muskoxen. We were the first to organize. We organized the first international reindeer caribou symposium. So we had it broad because most of our work was focused on caribou here, but we're doing some work with reindeer here. Plus, we also had this reindeer work being done on the Seward Peninsula with the other people at the UAF. And reindeer was a focus for a lot of the work going on in northern Scandinavia and in Russia, as well as what with caribou, which they called over there wild reindeer. And so we interacted with all of these people at these meetings, which occurred every 3 to 4 years, once every 3 to 4 years. So we started the first one here, and then the next one was in Norway, I think, and the next one was in, might have been Canada, and the next one in and there was another one in Sweden, one in Greenland. And about this time, I'd primarily, because I was doing a lot of work with muskoxen and had grad students working on the North Slope mainly. And so we did an international muskox symposium. And we did two of those. It was mostly Canada and Alaska. But there was some experience from Greenland with muskoxen. And then Denmark was scheduled to host the next one because of the Greenland work with caribou. And the guy that was the chief organizer was working with the caribou, but they had started working with muskoxen. And so his attitude was, why don't we just meld those two together? So it's the International Arctic Ungulate Conference. So muskoxen and caribou and reindeer are all ungulates, and they're the only ones that are adapted to life in the Arctic. The muskoxen, caribou, and reindeer are two species, really, because reindeer and caribou are the same. So that was good, too, and then those went on.
So what year did you do the first one?
There's dates on all of this I can't come up with. It was probably in the 70s, early 70s. But, and there were part of the deal was, too, if we organized it, the organizers were supposed to put out the proceedings. So there would be something, a record. And for the most part, that happened not as smoothly as it should at times, but we got stuck often, I did, and Bob White and Jack Lewick, and then Peter Lent, who was assistant unit leader, who had done a lot of work with caribou and some with reindeer. So all of the three of us were, three or four of us were a committee and shared the editing and stuff, and although we'd lay it on those who had the experience and ability and then the time. But we worked as a team, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just laid on one person's shoulders.
Well, how many researchers would participate in these conferences?
Well, the attendance would be, we'd get, since they're only, say, about 4 years, and sometimes the host country couldn't get their act together, like Finland, it took them 5 years or something like that. And Russia, which, or Soviet Union, which wanted to host it, that they couldn't do it. Until the last one, I think, that was done, and it was in Yakutia, and it was, you know, it was a disaster in terms of pulling it together. But anyway, most of them were good once they got going, and we went to, they were usually hosted in a place where you could get people out in the field associated with it, which was always. You know, if you're going to a place where there's caribou and reindeer, and you can get out there and with the others, and they have organized field excursions, the focus would be on that. If they wanted to do excursions on their own after the conference, yeah, we'd encourage that. But that could be maybe to look at human cultures and architecture or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about the number of researchers at these conferences, 50 people, 200 people?
Oh, about around 100.
Okay.
And at the maximum, but it went over sometimes. It depends on how many locals could be attending in a given situation.
I was thinking, the reason I was asking was putting together the proceedings. To put together 100 papers in a proceedings is a big task.
There wouldn't be 100 papers, because especially a lot of locals were not presenting papers, or there were papers from a group of them. Mm-hmm. But if they had, they all wanted to come and had found travel money, because we didn't have any travel money. We tried to find sheep housing and things like that, and sometimes housing for students, you know, where students wouldn't have to pay anything. But there were a few that we got students over. The one in Greenland, we were able to get about four of my students were able to go all doing projects there, some on Musraxon and some on caribou. And that was so great for them, because it was this fabulous experience to go there. To begin with, and to get there, you had to go through Copenhagen,
right?
And so you get exposure to, and then usually be meeting up with some Danes there. That would be, and so the students then were meeting these people and getting opportunities to talk. And they were all always in English, although we had. The Finns put one on, and they had simultaneous translation for Russian English and Russian or English or other, to Finnish sometimes, because Finns weren't all that good in some of these other languages. Mm-hmm. They were good compared to other places. And, well, at any rate, and these deals, you know, you'd make connections and you'd share data and stuff with people in other countries that were doing similar work, and that was one of the reasons for the conferences. And then this often meant we would, here at UAF, we'd take on a foreign student to work on a master's degree here or on a postdoc project. Mm-hmm. And there were some exchanges in the other direction, but it was usually because the English was a common language, and from especially Scandinavians, they could handle the English by the time they were doing graduate work quite well. And whereas to bring people over from Russia or other places was, and plus Scandinavia, usually they had some support from within the country.
Right.
To help them travel, students to travel, whereas it wasn't the case in Russia. But And then there was, in Greenland, there were some, many native students could get there frequently. And there was good exchanges, moderately good exchanges, through the Northern Studies program and stuff like that.
So because of these symposium and conference, you know, conferences, you started meeting other researchers in other countries doing what you were doing, and then you propose, well, I'd like to come and work in your country, and start building collaborations?
They would invite you to come, and they didn't have, or you'd say, well, it'd be great if we could get together and get out in the field in Greenland with you or something like that. And because I had these connections, especially if the sabbatical with the Norwegians, that, you know, when I was over there on sabbatical, we were doing collaborative research on caribou, wild reindeer. And then in Greenland, I had already been doing research there, because some of the early work I'd done in Denmark with roe deer, mm-hmm. the same people, they graduated into becoming working in Greenland. And that research institute that I was associated with to work with roe deer, there was nobody working in Greenland then. But then the Greenlandic government was wanting to get more attention focused on, well, the Greenlandic government didn't exist then as a separate entity.
That was part of Denmark still.
Yeah. And of course it still is, but they have a lot of stronger voice, and they want to be more involved in things like wildlife management, whether it's terrestrial wildlife or marine or whatever, everything. So at any rate, the way I got into connected with the situation in Iceland was two young biologists, one was botanist and the other was wildlife ecologist, and Icelandic, and they got problems because they're at that level that these two guys were fluent in English, but we'd been invited over there for other symposium. Both Bob White and I separately, and dealt with grazing lands and they did have a. They didn't have a lot of people working with the wild reindeer, and Iceland had introduced reindeer in the 1700s in about three places. They got them from Norway, I think, and they put them in areas. Well, there's no area in Iceland that isn't going to be used by sheep, especially in those days. And so it was a matter of having another wildlife there, and it was starting in that time. It was like it was here when bringing reindeer to Alaska. There was no firm government policy other than that the farmers shouldn't shoot them for meat or because they thought of them as competing with their sheep. On the other hand, some of them thought, oh, it'd be great, so we wouldn't have to shoot our own sheep to eat, and we could, they produce, then wool was the big thing mm-hmm. for sheep, and within the country, lamb for meat. So then the only one in one area, one of the more remote areas around where there's most biggest ice cap is, that was the only place where there were the introduction took and they were there, and it was remote for the sheep herders. They would drive sheep up into those areas, but close to the glaciers. But it was Then they'd have to round them up in the wintertime because the winters up there, the higher elevations were more severe. And but the caribou did fine, or relatively fine. There was always, in the early days, a lot of poaching by the locals. And but if they were remote, it was hard for them to get to where they were. Well, what happened there was there was Iceland was starting to develop big hydro projects as a source of economy. And what would they do with the energy, electric energy? They already had geothermal energy, and they had a lot of water power because they had all this high country with glaciers and plenty of rain, and then these big waterfalls.
Yeah.
And they could, there was some controversy about they don't want to dam a big waterfall that was a major tourist attraction. So, but there was lots of others, and so they started that way. And then, well, who wants cheap energy? Aluminum processing. So they were able to sell the energy before they actually built the dams because they had far more than they could use. And so they, aluminum companies would be mining the ore in Africa and other places, and they load it on a ship. They could come to Iceland by ship and have a processing plant right there on the coast, and they have plenty of electricity. So they didn't have to have use coal or other fossil fuels for the processing.
Mm-hmm. So when did you first start doing field work in Iceland?
I think it was in the early 1980s. So they invited these two young guys who I was impressed with that were starting these studies because they had the money for the environmental studies. You know, what was the damming was going to dam a lot of habitat that was good for the caribou as well as sheep. And it was in an area where it was particularly rich biologically because on the northern side, on the southern side, it, you know, when there's a volcano right in the middle of this ice field, and when it erupts, it causes flooding and everything, and it, most of that goes down to the south side, and there it washes out bridges because it's just a narrow bit of land between the ice cap and the sea, and the main highway there is that goes around the southern part of Iceland and into that, into the only two or three towns over there on the coast. And fishing is where what most of the towns were living on. And so it changed the economy a bit, but they had the funding to do these environmental studies as what would be the impact. And there were different ways of damming rivers so that you could dam two or three smaller ones and then not have smaller reservoirs, or you could have one or two big ones, which are usually not good because they interfered with everybody. And it was hard enough to get around in that country because there were no bridges, and you'd have these roaring streams, glacier-fed streams, that had cut down in the lava, steep cliffs and their big canyons, spectacular. You'd walking on the tundra up on the higher part, and you'd see this fog, and there's just a line of fog, and what's that? Well, it's not fog, it's spray from the roaring canyons and the water rushing down there, all, you know, full of glacial silt, too. And anyway, it was, so they, because I had focused heavily on the vegetation and the plant-animal impact, whereas other people like our Fish and Game was focusing on population dynamics of the caribou and as a basis for management without much focus. And that's where I was frequently at odds with state and other work, caribou work in North America, that too many people were focusing on things other than the relationship of the animals to their food and how that had accounted for there to be separate herds and migrating separately, that the winter range was important, the summer range was important, the calving grounds was important. And then, you know, why are these herds separate, and are the calving grounds comparable? And well, some longer-term research showed that, no, they were different. And why were they different and still be used as calving grounds? And, well, some of the reasons were it was the best place for them to calve because there were a lot of lichens there. And during this brief transition from winter grazing to summer, they could do as well there as they could where there wasn't many lichens and everything is greening up. Might affect the timing of calving a little bit and things like that. And then predation, where there are more predators in one place or another. And so, but I was focusing mainly on what were they getting specifically, what plants were they focusing on, and what was the ratio of lichens to others in this transition period during migration as well as others. So I was considered sort of an expert on the plant-animal focus, and that fit well into what they wanted to find out about the in Iceland. It was a question of plants as supporting sheep grazing and the reindeer. There are only one population of wild reindeer, and that numbered about 700 or 800 animals. But they allowed hunting under a quota system by locals or by people that would go there and hunt. And some of the locals, that farmers then realized they could, if the hunters coming from Reykjavik or from overseas, Europe, to hunt these wild with the big antlers and stuff, the locals' farms, they could act as bed and breakfast or even guiding. And so they could make money. And the economies were always very Spartan in terms of income for locals. They were living close to the productivity of the land and too focused on just one thing like sheep and wool. So
you went to Iceland and worked with these young biologists, botanists, and what particularly were you looking at?
Well, they took me I was mainly an advisor for them. They took me in the field, and so I could get a feeling of the vegetation types, which were very similar in terms of alpine flora, but Iceland was different because it was so isolated from every place else and was volcanic in origin. It didn't have a lot of things, like they didn't have any native big carnivores like bears or wolves, and they did have Arctic foxes, and that was about the extent of it. And they didn't have small voles that were competing, and they didn't have hares that were competing, and they didn't have they did have ptarmigan, but wildlife wasn't usually competitive except for the caribou and sheep. And so if farmers could diversify by having income from several sources, and they were also starting to plant forests there, and it was a slow process, and they were coming over to Alaska, soil conservation people from Iceland, and getting plants that were good for helping restore habitat that was destroyed by overgrazing by the sheep went from the Viking era in areas that were volcanic soils, which are very easily erodible. And once they're eroded, you're not left with much except a sort of a scree. And to get that back into grass production, you have to fertilize for a while and not overgraze. And prevent erosion. And that's where the plants that they were getting, like lupin, they were getting from the Kenai And it did very well because it was a nitrogen fixture in the soil, and so you didn't have to fertilize as much. And they could put them in erosion dishes, and pretty soon the whole thing was loaded with blue lupin. But if the sheep are stressed with not enough food, they eat lupin too much. It's toxic to them.
But yeah, so they put lupin in thinking that the sheep wouldn't eat the lupin.
Yep.
Is what you're saying.
Which happened. But then if you go through a generation or so of people, you have all this less lupin there that the sheep aren't eating. And the farmers, some of the younger farmers were saying, oh, this was a terrible mistake. You should never introduce lupin there. But if they hadn't introduced the lupin, they wouldn't have any grazing area there, and they would have lost more soil. And so it wasn't that big a deal, I mean. But it's a little difficult to get rid of the lupin unless if it's in ditches like that in places where it's controlling erosion. And it was just, you know, why shouldn't we get grasses and stuff in there? Well, you could after the enrichment by the lupin, but it's a gradual process. And how do you get rid of the lupin? And, well, it's like lupin grows up on the north slope, and it's eaten a little bit when it's just coming up, because it's not toxic then. And the floral parts are favored by the caribou during the early flowering. And that's non-toxic and highly digestible and good source of food. But later in the summer, no, they avoid eating the lupin.
Well, it's sort of like that ground cover we have that's now this big invasive species.
The vetch. Yeah, that's right.
They put something in to deal with one problem and it creates another problem.
Yeah, and it's introduced from the lower 48 and hay that was brought in here.
Right. So the lupins in Iceland, they put in for a reason, but then they became the problem?
I think it was an accident that it came in here, because I had personal experience in that when I worked for the experimental farm, there was one patch only of this blue lupin right on the entrance across the road from the entrance to the experimental farm. And it was there, and nobody thought it was a nice blue deal, and nobody thought it was a bad species. But over time, it gradually spread, and it's like starting from one little spot, it takes a long time for it to spread. Whereas once it gets moved around onto the road systems, and especially with the wintertime, plows move the seed along in wind, and it grows well on the shoulders.
Now, you're talking about the vetch or the lupin?
Vetch.
The vetch, right. Because lupin are a native species to the Arctic, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on the Kenai, it was probably a slightly different species than the one in the Arctic, but the Kenai was, the climate conditions were more like Iceland.
Right.
So at any rate, the main thing that I did was size up the situation with these guys and then figure out the best way to do studies. So in essential, you did some line transects and had study plots where so you could identify the vegetation types and show the seasonality of the quality of the forage for grazing animals. And lichens were not as big a factor as in other areas because the winter season was shorter there and a lot of rain. Plus, like other places, some of the good grazing areas were, well, even by the airport, the road out to the airport, which is quite a ways from Reykjavik.
Right.
It's old lava fields, which are pretty sterile. The only thing growing there would be a little bit of one kind of moss, which animals don't usually eat, and then a few lichens on the rocks.
So what are the sheep eating?
Well, there was a little patches where grass had get started, and it was mainly of building soil up as erosion took place over hundreds of years. So the sheep would move around broadly, so you couldn't have very many sheep there.
Right.
So they didn't, where they were able to do the most in recreating, well, during the Viking era, when they first got there, there were a lot of birch forests. And the birches, some of them got this big.
Six inches.
But they didn't. You know, they're more twisted a bit. In the southern part of Iceland, had these, where the early settlement occurred, had these valleys with a lot of wood. Well, wood was valuable because it could be used for construction of mainly... How do you build a sod house? How do you have a hold up the roof? Well, driftwood is one way, but you don't, not that much driftwood.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would use, birch was great for that, and then they used it for boat building, and that was just too much. And one of the reasons they became farmers instead of fishermen, there was era when Vikings had settled, and there was population was up to, you know, 30,000 or 40,000 people, and they, big deal for the Vikings to settle there, as they get all this land and they could have a big farm. Which Vikings originally were farmers and seafarers. In Norway, they had farms, and they were also seafarers and raiders, and the men and the women would say. And older people and manage the farm, mm-hmm. when they're out looting and spoiling and trading and settling.
Right.
So so in this one area, there was this big estuary that was mainly volcanic ash that had been eroded after a big eruption of, mm-hmm. one of the big volcanoes that erupts every 5 or 6 years. And this ash, it walked down there, and it has potential to be good soil. It created this huge wetland estuary, and it became popular for migrating geese to hang out in these places. And, of course, they were harvested by the farmers, Viking farmers. But it was, the soils could be, they were very erodible if they weren't, but it being flat, apparently flat, it wasn't as erodible as up on slopes, hill slopes. Mm-hmm. So there they created this Soil Conservation Service early on, because they finally realized, and it was them that showed that this erosion had gone. The erosion had been, you know, you had soil that was like this, a meter and a half thick, mm-hmm. was ash that gradually built up over thousands of years, and it had vegetation, a nice mat of vegetation. But if you grazed it too heavily and broke that mat, then you could erosion on slopes, right, all the rain that they have and melting snow and everything, it would just wash the stuff away.
It would be sort of comparable,
and wind.
Comparable to melting permafrost. That
almost, but it wasn't permafrost.
Right.
And but it, also they're very erodible. And sometimes you see these pillars that when the size of this house, and they had, still had a vegetative cover, but all around it is drop off to this scree and rocks.
Mm.
And animals grazing and moving between these places and eat a blade of grass here and blade of grass there. If they could get that stuff back into production, well, it's very hard, and they've done some good work, and including aerial seeding and aerial fertilizing to get things started and keeping the sheep out. Mm-hmm. And then, but in this big estuary, they did amazing things there. They learned how to drain it without these wetlands, and they were not all that productive, except for migrating geese. It was a handy place to stop and eat a bit, but it wasn't really highly productive for other wetland uses. Mm-hmm. You could graze some animals to a limited extent on it. But what they did was, early on, they were grazing a lot of horses there, and then they grazing had the advantage it converted a lot of the organic matter into other nutrients, mm-hmm. including mixing the organic matter with the soil, the ash. But they were able to finally realize you could fertilize a bit, and you can make fertilizer from with this hydroelectric mm-hmm. energy. You could make fertilizer, and then they went. It was highly productive. They could produce this highest quality alfalfa, and then they could pelletize that stuff, and they'd use plenty of energy. They could dry it, and then they sell that to the farmers and not too high a price, and they could feed it to their sheep and all winter long when they couldn't be grazing them out and losing them in the wintertime from tough storms and what. So this whole area was so rich and green, and it's amazing. And they could be used big equipment to harvest it, and they grew a lot of vegetables too and things like that.
So what was your role in all this in Iceland?
Well, we spent a lot of time with the soil conservation people. They wanted to meet with us, and we were involved in some exchanges here in Alaska with them and getting them over here, the soil conservation people. My particular role when I worked over there for a couple of months was working with these two young biologists, and it was a very learning experience for me. But yeah, we could help them design experiments, and they were good learners, and it was a terrific area to work in because they were down in the lower areas. There were a good road system, just gravel roads, but there were farms that were widely separated, sheep farms, mm-hmm. and then they had regional schools, so the farmers would take their kids and drop them off at school and pick them up a month and a half and take them home, or they could bring them, they were closer to where the farms were, they could come home an occasional weekend or something, but they had to provide their transportation. And farmers all had four-wheel drive wheels, so they could handle the roads even in the winter usually. And there was some road maintenance. And we stayed in one of these farms. And the reason we stayed at this particular one was the farmer's wife had died. Well, she was probably in her 50s when she died. And so the farmer had three children, two boys, younger boys, and then a daughter. And the daughter was a girlfriend of the one of the biologists. So he worked out that we would stay there and pay them for some kind of rent, and we would eat smart. They would provide all the food and cook it and stuff. So the daughter was home at that time because it was in summer. Mm-hmm. So she helped a lot of the work, but the farmer himself, of course, had to do this when she was going to university in the wintertime. And that's
what a great experience to be. You know, you had that in the Soviet Union, too, to have that local.
Especially that we're living with them and you could get, you know, how they were so dependent upon what they could grow themselves because it's so costly to buy stuff. Well, they had plenty of land, and but they're happy to have go out and hunt a few reindeer. Mm-hmm. And they had had these fields that that they could produce some hay for feeding the sheep, and they sometimes usually had they had a couple of cows milking, and so they produced this wonderful kind of yogurt that was skyr, which is it's a special kind of dessert. And so, you know, what would you have? The primary meals were ham and, not ham, a mutton, mm-hmm. and, but cooked in various ways, you know, stews, and right. a lot of this fresh fried on the frying pan, and with a good gravy, and then boiled potatoes. They could grow potatoes.
Right.
And boiled potatoes, there'd be some vegetables, like they could grow cabbage and things like that. Mm-hmm. And they bought some things, you know, onions they probably couldn't grow them there, but they used onions and flavoring. But they were pretty standard, and sometimes they would have some fish that you could get dried. You could get dried cod, and it wasn't very expensive because they fished it on the coast areas, and that wasn't too expensive.
So yeah. Where was most of your research based out of then? These farms, or did you travel all over the country of Iceland?
Well, it was mainly this one region on the north side of this big glacier, and we had... And we could use a conventional station wagon or something to travel out into that general area that was provided by the Icelandic government. And then they had to use, also provided by the Icelandic government, some four-wheel drive rig. Well, at that stage, you know, the cheapest four-wheel drive things were military surplus Russian four-wheel drive. Mm-hmm. All I can say for them is that they were tough because they were sounded like they were coming apart, and they had to put them in the shop and do maintenance. But they were sort of like big Jeeps, you know, with closed cab, and yeah, they. Then you would be traveling on roads along ridge tops where there's no road. It's just old volcanic ash and boulders and stuff. And sheep farmers might have moved a few boulders out of the way. And then we get up there. There was one. We got went as close as we could get on a conventional road, and then. Two of us got out, and we started this long hike. And then the other guy had food for two or three days, and he went back down and then picked up this four-wheel drive rig and was able to go on a different route. See, the problem is these big rivers, you couldn't cross these rivers. No. There weren't any bridges. Except maybe one or two down low, and where they started fanning out, and so if you wanted to get this area, you had to go here. But then to get to just across this canyon, you had to go all the way down and come up the other way, or do it separately.
You can't get there from here.
Sort of, but you could get there. But it's just it'd be a separate expedition.
Right.
But then we did this long hike and. And finally, we got up. We were up high, and we saw. Well, we knew that we were going to a hut which was like a Wanagon on skids, mm-hmm. that had been hauled in there associated with the sheep herding. And it was, they didn't tell me at the time, but it was right on the one of these canyons edge. So you could see the canyon there. And I wondered about the water. And so I said, how do you get water there? And they said, well, we've got a spring right there. It turns out it was a hot spring. And that was, so we hiked. That's and
pretty luxurious field situation.
Well, this guy that got there with the truck earlier, and there was, I think, one other technician that was based there, and that bunk, this Wanagon, you know, was about the size of here to the deal, and said bunks.
What's that, like 20 feet?
15? Yeah. You know, like you could pull it on a tractor, mm-hmm. on skids, and that's why you got it in the wintertime. And then it had a little stove that burnt kerosene or something, mm-hmm. like that, and they had to bring that in. But just outside, just, you know, not too many feet away, was this hot spring, and it was like built up incrustation of stuff, mm-hmm. and so it was right at, you know, like a drinking fountain. So oh. you could go up there, and it didn't have a lot of bad stuff in it. So it was, you know, you could drink it. It was okay. It didn't have a lot of sulfur and stuff. And you could take this thing. The temperature of the water was about 100 degrees. And you could take it in a tea kettle, and boy, it had hot water for tea and stuff in the short order of cooking. But then when we were hiking back toward this place, they saw that there was a pool, and that was vegetated around this pool, and it was warm water, and they were swimming and it, stripped down and went swimming. And that's when we got, after we'd hiked a long days, and before we had a meal, we did a dip in the hot springs. And it was good water too. That was same kind of water. It was a little smoky colored, but not much. And it was, they'd been using this thing for a long time. And so that was very luxurious.
Yes.
I never expected that quite like that way.
So you have to let your water cool off for drinking water?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had your water bottle that you brought in with you, and they brought maybe a little bit of water because we were frequently not there at that spring. Mm-hmm. And so we had a water in the vehicle in a bigger plexus container. But that was good because the botanist was really, he didn't know his stuff really well. He was not trained much in wildlife ecology, but he was excellent botanist. And his major research he was doing in his doctoral degree was based on the nunataks that stick up through the ice and with vegetation on them. He was sort of the world expert, was his major professor there at the university in Reykjavik. And but he was a top-notch guy. And then the other guy was also an excellent biologist. And they were a good team. They got along really well together. The botanist was gay. Didn't know it at the time, mm-hmm. but when I visited him later on in Reykjavik, when he was associated with the Botanical Museum, he had come out of the closet, mm-hmm. and he was a little bit different guy because he was getting involved in politics, mm-hmm. but he had a lot more self-confidence once he came out too about himself.
Right.
And the other guy had married this gal and started a family, and he was sort of the chief while I work in Iceland. So I was, it's fun working with young people that are so good and talented and eager to learn. And because I was always eager to learn, but I had the experience that and the research and other things that I could draw on, and felt good about being able to work with them. And I was always interested as much in the people and the cultures and how they live with the land. And Iceland is just a remarkable place because they have this Reykjavik, there's no smokestacks.
Right.
Because they got all this hot water, and they up on top of a hill, they got this huge swimming pool that's public swimming pool and showers and everything, very modern. And then the reasonable-sized towns usually, in most cases, have big swimming pools in for the kids in school, and they've had Olympic swimming medalists. What do you think? It's unusual for a little place
like Reykjavik.
Iceland. And and there's like only about 300,000 people in all of Iceland.
Mm-hmm. So what years was it that you were going to Iceland when you worked with these
It was
two
in the early
guys?
1980s, I think. Okay. But I'll have to check the dates on those. And then...
So you ended up publishing with those guys?
No, I don't think I published anything there because they had to make reports in Icelandic for what they did, and they presented papers at the International Symposium on their work. And my work wasn't, they acknowledged help, but I wasn't involved in the research directly. So
you were just sort of showing them how to do habitat-based research?
Right. And we helped them arrange an opportunity for them to do more education in, I think it was Sweden, where when we did the International Reindeer Caribou Symposium there. And so they were able to do more Swedish work. But we had... we've had connections, the University of Alaska, with Icelandic people, and we had one guy who was on the faculty now in UAA who was an expert on lichens and on tree-lined vegetation, and a really nice guy. I mean, he did some work with collaboration with me and Bob White when we were doing some modeling work on the North Slope, and I'll think of his name, but at any rate, and we would have, I did this graduate course on herbivory, and it was we labeled it grazing ecology, I think, and we went, we'd have this, as part of the course, it was a graduate level or upper division, and we'd go out in late winter to and stay in this cabin in Cantwell. And he would come up and bring a grad student. So here's, UAA and UAF working together, which is a good deal. And it was good for the students to get mix there in the field. And we go out in the field together. And Bart's Feinborn son. His name. He's a nice guy. And a good guy to have on the faculty down there in Anchorage. So
was it just that one project with those guys, or did you do other work in Iceland?
I got around and they showed me around, so I became familiar with the soil conservation centers too. Sometimes while I was over there, I'd go out with them, and they'd show me some of these places where they're starting to grow trees, where they could grow usually conifers of different kinds that grow at that latitude, but the seeds had never got there before. And they would have been cut down and used when there were enough, but now they're starting to produce wood themselves for telephone poles and fences and mm-hmm. stuff like that, and some lumber. But Iceland, you know, it's, and yet Reykjavik, there's no wood frame houses because they don't have any wood, or I shouldn't say no, but virtually none. And so they're all concrete, and they can be extremely cold unless designed properly. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there's a lot of mass there, and if they're warm, they don't cool off so much, and they hold the heat better.
Right.
So, and of course, they like to have windows, but virtually no landscaping. It's starting to change now, but they didn't have, the Vikings didn't have landscape.
No. Well, you were there a little bit more recently than the Vikings.
But even in early days in Norway, when I was over there, the rural areas, you know, you're surprised that there's no landscaping around the houses. Mm. And that was sort of the way in New England, where I lived in Vermont. You frequently wanted the snow to drift up around the base of your house because they weren't insulated very well and sealed very well. And they used to, one technique to reduce heat loss or in New England and these old houses which are part of a farmstead mm-hmm. or something, is you built out a deal with some boards, and then you took all the leaves from the trees and you put them in there. So you use this, you had about this high around
feet.
The base of the concrete or stone.
Yes, like 2 or 3 feet wide insulation around
yeah.
the base.
And makes all around sense. The house.
Yeah, that makes
so
sense.
That stopped any, if you had wind, stopped wind blowing, but it was insulating too. And you were getting heat loss from the house itself, and
yeah.
this would reduce the heat loss. Because they were very poorly insulated in the walls in those early days.
Yeah. So what about Greenland? When did you first go there and why?
The first time I went there was,
for one of those symposia, maybe?
I've been there so many times. But the first time I went was when we had a postdoc. Well, he wasn't a postdoc. He was a grad student who had finished in Europe at that time, a doctorate degree was at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you did it necessarily, a lot of the work, you did the final write-up after about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a lot of research. And then it was like a monograph, and you had to defend that. So you didn't have to do a lot of time at the university, but you have to do a lot of time getting the data and what. So this one student had been, did I meet him when I was working on the roe deer? No, he wasn't there. But I think I did, because he was a student then in Denmark in biology, and he and his wife managed to get some funding. I met him, and he was working part-time at this research station where he was working on the roe deer. And so I got funding we got some funding. And then he was able to get some Danish money for study abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his wife, she was his wife then, I think they were already married, but they hadn't had kids because they both wanted to finish their education. And she was in exercise physiology.
Mm-hmm.
So she... both of them came over here, and she took some courses here, and he did too, and he did some work with me, mainly with me then, out on a little bit with Bob White, but mainly with me, and the funding was through the wildlife unit that I had. And we worked out on the Western Arctic caribou herd, where I had a student studying foraging behavior in late winter on the Western Arctic herd. And we lived in a big white wall tent with a wood stove in a little valley that had some trees, but most of it was open tundra around there. So it was not too far from Kotzebue, flying in to get there. And so he wanted to do a project. The student I had was doing a master's project on the behavior and energetic costs of foraging time in different types of the habitat that was there. And then the Danish student, he said he wanted to work on the energy costs for the animal foraging. So, you know, how much was involved in actually digging a crater, a feeding crater, and they get data like by observing. The two of them could work together because they were getting somewhat similar information, but they were using it differently, and collecting data differently and for different projects. And they worked terrific. They were good. They work well. They bring a long bond of friendship. And I spent time out in the field on the Seward Peninsula with them, and that was as well as on the Seward Peninsula, as well as up in the Waring Hills, where we had this camp and in the mountains, and we always use that type of winter camp, and where if wood was available, it was wonderful to have a wood stove, and you could. You know, it was just in late winter when temperatures would drop down to 30 below at night, and it was. We should have had what we couldn't afford at the wildlife unit, a double line, double canvas. But these were pretty good because, and we'd make a bed up high and then have a couple of logs, and then have it down to the ground where you had the stove. So you could sit on the, and then you'd put boughs on the bed, and then your air mattress on top of those. You're lucky and had some caribou or reindeer skins, you could put those down first, and they were really very comfortable. And those guys just loved that as well as did I. We spent time cutting a little wood, but we could handle all that. And so he did did a nice write-up, and we got that published in the biological papers of the
But he did that where he came here.
Yeah. So then he went back, and then he was working on his PhD in Greenland in West Greenland on caribou. Then he invited me to come over. He got some money to allow me to partly pay for coming over and spending a couple of weeks with him. And his wife was in the field with him. They had they were based at this airfield that had been, during the war, was U.S. military, and then gradually it became Danish. And Sondastromford, now I gave it the Icelandic name, it's called Kangerjussarak. But it's the main flights can come in there from Copenhagen, so it wasn't all that expensive. Whereas if you went someplace in Greenland, once you got there by air, then it's really expensive because they have to use big enough planes that, but also then land on little strips, and they weren't a lot of the villages don't have any, and they have to use helicopters to get around, etc. At any rate.
And this was in Western Greenland?
This was in West Greenland, right. Okay. So these were caribou that had been there from various earliest explorers. And there was no wolves there. Wolves never got there. The caribou was assumed came across the ice on the David and Baffin Bay and Davis Strait from Canada, Arctic Canada archipelago, but they were obviously a long time ago, and but wolves never made it across, and they were later DNA work showed that. That they weren't peri-caribou from the northern Canada, northernmost Canada. They were barren ground caribou, like the caribou in the big herds in northern Canada.
But they were able to adapt?
Pardon?
Isn't barren ground caribou in their habitat a little bit different than they'd find in Greenland?
The habitat is what?
A little bit different than what they would find when they got to Greenland.
Well, not in West Greenland. West Greenland is a unique place in that it's you have quite a bit of area between the ice cap and the sea, and there's big fjords that go away and close to the ice cap almost, sometimes close enough so that you're getting ice going into the fjord. But traditionally, the archaeological work showed that native people would make expeditions with big skin boats, whole community of family, extended families and what, and a couple of kayaks and some sleds, and they would go in by boat, by skin boat, and then, or go on sleds on the ice in the fjord in late winter, just about late winter, when the land is already pretty free of snow, and they would go overland into these lake systems where the caribou, when moving seasonally from out closer to the sea inland to the mountains, the ice, in search of the best food for them, when they're close to the inland ice, there was not many lichens there, because it was so dry, they didn't go so well, and they grow slowly, and the caribou would eat them faster than they could grow. But you had a lot of other vegetation, and during this, it was good summer range, because you had enough precipitation so that you could have vegetation, sedges and grasses and dwarf willows and stuff. And then if you go out to the western coast, closer to the sea, then there's more precipitation. The snow would be deeper, so frequently it would be too deep for the caribou to dig through to get lichens. But lichens grew well out there. So there's this transition, gradual increasing lichens as you went to the coast, but the availability of the caribou was dependent on snow and how the snow fell, etc. And then what was controlling the population, because the harvest by native people was not, they were mainly living off the sea, even though they'd make expeditions and live at certain times a year in where they could harvest a lot of caribou, and then they'd go back to their villages and go. So it was, their whole lives were seasonal in relationship to what was the best way to harvest food for them. So they were mainly marine mammal and fish dependent people, but they did these big harvest, and we could go to an archaeological site where they did this, and one place that was where they did the hunting, it was right a narrow valley where you could, it's very narrow, and then this stream that was, wasn't a roaring stream, it was a clear water stream too. I had fish in it, but the bank was eroding there, and it was kind of mountainous around there, so it had had more ice earlier at times. And but people, you could see these old traps where they would, and blinds where they built with rocks, and they would, right where the range of rocks, so when they could only move on this narrow trail, and mm-hmm. then they could, then.
Oh yeah, they herded the.
Herded them. And then in this other place where they went with their boats and kayaks, well, there, just the bank was eroding and it was just loaded with caribou bones. And occasionally you could find an old broken flint point or something. Mm-hmm. But then the other place where they went, it was the way they harvested mostly was, this was a, you know, it was a big social event for the natives, and been a lot of good archaeological work there that showed how they'd line up rocks to make it look like people from a distance.
Yeah, the Inukshuk.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did all like what they did in Anaktuvik Pass area.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they would, these would funnel down to an hourglass-shaped lake, and then they would swim across this lake. Well, they, this is where they used their kayaks, mm-hmm. and they would spear the caribou in the when they're swimming.
Right.
But while they were driving them, they would have people hiding behind rocks, and you could make some kills that way. But they also had this rocks, flat rocks, up on a nice slope that was on a hill that was kind of like a game, a hopscotch. Hmm. And yeah, you could still use it and jump from one to another, and it would go, and it was, you know, it was 100 yards long. And so people waiting for the caribou to come could have something to occupy them. Then they had places where they had almost like winter homes, but not quite, where they would have fires on using willow, mainly dead willow, because there were some places that were willow this high. Mm-hmm. And there they would, they'd obviously when they go in there, they're not using these, weren't using these at this time, but it wasn't very long before that they were being used.
And so when was it you went to started going to Greenland?
It was in the 80s sometimes.
Also in the 80s?
I think, yeah.
Okay.
And so then, yeah, so I spent some time there, and it was just terrific.
Did you have a particular research focus you were looking at?
Well, again, they wanted me to come and go with them, and so I could see what the terrain was like. And he's doing his PhD, and so he wants ideas of how he should approach this. Mm-hmm. And so I did that, and it was both he and his wife were terrific, you know, and it was nice that she could be out there with him. So she took leave from what her education while she was out there and, you know, helped out in the field and cooked and stuff. And did when we did hikes, long hikes, it was good hiking. And she was always involved too. And mm-hmm. they were top-notch physical condition, as was I. And sometimes we were in close enough so you could see the ice and would hike up there. Mm-hmm. But the situation is to have this big mass of ice, and they get collects the moisture out of the air and turns it into snow and ice, and then you get these cold air drainage when it's cold, cool weather. You get the cold air drainage from up high. By the time it gets down to the edge, it's a wind, strong mm-hmm. wind. It's called a fern wind. And that the wind can be really powerful. You have to be careful with a tent. If you got a good tent, that can suffer that. But maybe keep you awake all night with a thing
And what? Happy. How do you spell it? Furn?
Furn. F-U-R-N, I think.
And that's it.
I have to look it up. And
is that a Scandinavian word? Or?
Yeah. And it's being its use in describing those type of winds and in other places where you have glaciers. I always felt the time that, you know, I was not giving enough for what they were getting, paying for to get me over there to work in as an assistant, not as assistant, but as an advisor. We had a really strong relationship developed between us because of his work over here, and I'd worked with him in the field over here, and he's just really a top-notch, dedicated guy.
It's just that brings up a point that some of all this work is not just the science, it's the relationships you build with each other, right. And then you, that fosters ideas and collaboration.
Exactly.
But how much you just learn from each other.
And I had the experience of how we would tackle something like this here in Alaska, and he knows the constraints on tackling it and was learning the constraints on tackling it in Greenland. And he was getting a lot of experience. And then and subsequently they lived in Greenland after he finished, even before he finished the degree, he was still doing research, and they were living in Nuuk rather than flying back and forth. And his wife then, she had a teaching certificate, so she started teaching, especially physical education, but also in general, and in the local schools. And of course, they were using Danish in the schools, and she could handle that, and she could handle English well. And they were learning a little bit of, especially Henning was learning a little bit of Greenlandic Inuit.
Kagalik, I think it's called. I think the dialect is Kagalik or Kangalik or something.
Right.
Language. And so what was this guy's name? You just said his name.
Henning is his first name, H-E-N-N-I-N-G, and his last name, T-H-I-N-G, Thing.
Henning Thing.
Henning Thing.
And he was Danish?
Yeah.
Yeah.
His wife was born in Poland, and she and her mother migrated to Denmark, associated with the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. And now... So did you do other, after you finished helping him, did you do other research in Greenland?
Yeah. And then for that, while Henning was becoming sort of an expert on wildlife in Greenland, and he worked well with the Greenlandic government and when it came about, as well as the Danish government. And then... he was over here. He made contacts with grad students, and one grad student that was a close friend, and he was one that was doing studies up on caribou and relative to the pipeline and how caribou movements were being affected by the pipeline, Dan Roby. And so Dan Roby was working on a master's degree with me on that aspect of it. And so they got to know one another here, and Henning got up on the North Slope once with him, I think, and got familiar with that operation. And then when Dan finished his master's degree, and I think he worked for Fish and Game for a short time here in Fairbanks, still doing work up there with Caribou. And
he's the one in Oregon now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then he, Henning had some funding for some of his research and for other work in Greenland, and they had funding for an assistant, and so he asked about the possibility of Dan going over there as his assistant. And frankly, I thought that would just be terrific, because Dan had, was developing to be just a really top-notch student, but his interests were broad, and he interested in marine birds too, and doing some work with them. And one of the projects that Henning had to deal with was to go up to the Thule and look at the distribution of caribou up there, because they would be pericaribou that come across from Ellesmere Island and the narrow strait there that is, at least portions of it, are frozen over in the winter. And so it was known that they're there periodically, but they didn't know whether they were a resident population or what. So they went up there, and then Dan saw they lived in one of these little native villages, and the natives were, in the springtime, they were harvesting these little dovekies, little seabirds. And they use a net. Mm-hmm. They get down there, and then they catch them in flight. And so they tied in with the interests, Danish government and Greenlandic interests, but mainly it was Danish government interests in banding some of these birds and working there with the natives so they could add some money. They could hire the natives to help catch them and teach them how to do it. And both Henning and Dan, this was frosting on the cake. It was just a wonderful experience and helped stimulate even more Dan's interest in marine bird physiology and ecology. But then the two of them worked together on the caribou work. Dan is a big husky guy, and Henning was husky, but he wasn't as big a frame, and they would be sometimes having these heavy loads they were carrying, the two of them, and when I've been in the field with Henning in East Greenland, I was over there again for work with muskoxen, and that was relating to the oil exploration by Amoco, who had had a deal with Greenland and the Greenlandic government to do seismic exploration on this peninsula called Jameson Land in East Greenland. The ice is usually closer to the sea there, but this is one deal so it's more of a narrow corridor. But it's not many people on the east compared to the west, because this ice hangs out close to the shore all summer long. It doesn't melt away completely usually, and so getting a ship in there is sometimes...
and there's not as much usable coastline because there's more ice.
Except for Jameson Land, where it's mostly...
Jameson Land?
Jameson Land. Probably has a different Greenlandic name.
Yeah.
And there was one village close to the one end of Jameson Land, but the muskoxen density was higher there than any other place originally in Greenland, and naturally. And they also had, wolves had gotten down there. They'd come around to the top. And where there was scattered places where there'd been muskoxen and there's Arctic hares and the same as in northern Greenland, northern Canada. And there were pericaribou or pericaribou-like in northeast Greenland, and they died out about 500 years ago, 600 years ago. And so you could still find antlers there. And that was, there's one antler, there's one that I picked up that's up there on the wall.
It's up on your wall.
From the extinct subspecies of caribou. But they were there when the explorers went there around the turn of the century, just before the turn of the century of 1800, end of the 1800s. And this was a sailing ship that went there, and they went ashore, and there were lots of caribou on Jameson Land. Mm-hmm. And they shot some, and they brought the skin and bones back from one to the Copenhagen Museum. And then there was like 5 or 6 years before another expedition, sailing expedition, got there. At that time, I don't think there was any village. The villages had been moved north like Canadians did from Angmassalik in the south part of southeast Greenland. At any rate, the caribou were gone. Mm-hmm. They had died. And there was one guy, a senior biologist who had done a lot of work in the old school way and really diligent and hard-working guy, but he did a lot of work based upon interviewing local people, the priests, and also he had data from a shipment of skins of caribou, which were valuable in those days. And it was all, everything had to be monitored closely because this was a colony of Denmark then. And so the big companies that handled that trade, and they wanted everything, government wanted everything to be recorded, including the number of ptarmigan that were killed and shipped out, the number of caribou, the number of seals, and all of the marine mammals and stuff. So this Danish biologist was able to kind of reconstruct a lot of the history of the Danish, of the caribou and that area, but not very much because it's like a different country on the other side with the ice in between and no communication in between. And
But so you were there to look at the muskox population. You were there to, in relation to this Amoco development. So what was it that you were doing?
We're trying to, I was working with Henning and a veterinarian and a team from the guy who had I'd worked with in Denmark on roe deer. He was head of one of the expeditions, one of the study groups, and he and Henning suggested that I come over and work with them. And I brought another grad student with me, Kent Jingfors, who was a Swede who had worked in Canada, and they worked, done some work as an undergraduate student in Canada on musk oxen in the Canadian Arctic, and then he applied for a master's with me, and he came. And it's just another, he and Dan Roby worked together. Dan assisted him when he was doing his muskox work in the Saddle Rochet area on the Arctic Refuge.
And so how do you spell?
They were a good team.
How do you spell Ken's last name?
J-I-N-G-F-O-R-S, I think. Ingfors.
F-O-R-S, okay.
And so he later became head of the, he was Canadian citizenship, even though he originally from Sweden. And he later became head of the Yukon Territorial Wildlife branch. And I think he's retired now. But he's a terrific guy. And he was like, he and Dan were very similar, you know, big, husky guys and could handle skiing and all this. And
well, you handled all that, even though you used to be a big husky guy.
That's one reason why we all got along so well. But then Kent came over and worked with us with musk oxen, and he had a lot of knowledge about musk oxen, and that was good. But what they were doing primarily is that they wanted to know if the Amoco was required to determine to pay for environmental studies, and one of them was, and they were going to do seismic research, which is explosions, you know, drill a shallow hole, and you explode it, and you have instruments on the surface that tell you a bit about the structure underneath. But that terrain was, it was a whole glacier outwash mostly, and so it wasn't, no, permafrost wasn't a factor. You could run a small tracked field, a big helicopter could lift it from place to place, and they could drill, you know, these holes and then rig them up. But this was right in the area where the muskox were in the summer, and pretty good concentrations of there'd be bands of muskoxen here and there. And so the approach they were using was they wanted to know how would the muskoxen respond to these explosions, because they would be close by to where they'd be foraging sometime. And would they, if they broke up in a group, if they were close to the explosions, was there mixing if they were between another groups? So how frequently did they mix with other groups, and how frequently was the exchange? Well, how do you figure that out? And well, one way is to life capture the dart the animals, and then we put ear tags with a big plastic number that you could read with the binoculars or spotting scope from a distance.
Yeah, I was going to say you mark each one with colored paint, but putting an ear tag in was probably...
No, we had to know the individual animals. They had to have numbers, because we didn't know whether those individuals are in the next group we saw, or were they mixing. And how were they mixing naturally? We needed to get all that information. So they had the veterinarian along, because they were darting these animals with the drug, and they wanted to be sure the minimum mortality involved in doing this. And then so how do you get close to safely to shoot these things with a dart, because they can be very dangerous if they take it, they're chasing you with a big bull or something. And the no trees to climb, and you can't rely on just shooting them. So they hired a native from the village, and it was legal for them to hunt muskoxen. And one of the things they wanted too to learn, not them, but the Danish and Greenlandic government, relative to managing the harvest of the muskoxen, as long as there are plenty of animals, taking some on a limited quota would be okay. And these people were most happy, because they didn't have that much available to them over there. There's marine mammals and birds, but that was somewhat seasonal. So they could go out in the wintertime and hunt muskoxen, and they found that they learned that it's bad to kill a muskoxen in a group, kill a big muskoxen in a group, because they're going to be responding to you as they're going to bunch up. And then how do you get to this animal that's laying on the ground? And because they don't know the difference.
Right. They just see it go hit the ground.
Yeah.
They don't know.
At any rate, so what the strategy was to, when the natives learned to hunting muskoxen, at first they realized it was a disaster to try to break up groups of by hunting. It's better to hunt small groups and kill all of the animals in a group.
Hmm.
And they found that the best way to do this, where they could get close to hold the animals and get close with the dogs that are sled dogs that are trained for hunting muskoxen.
Hmm.
So that muskoxen respond to the dogs as they would to wolves. They form their defensive circle and hold their ground, and the dogs are trained to run around and bark, but not to go in too close.
And yeah.
So that was good, and so they I went over there with Kent, and they had already learned technique, and it was working well. And
so they were using this technique of hunting. They were applying it to the darting. Were they actually hunting the muskox?
Who?
You, Kent, and you guys, for the research.
We were working with the effort to mark them, which meant hunting them but not killing
right.
them.
Right. Exactly. That's my point. Yeah. You were using the hunting techniques, but you were just darting
them. The native guy who had been trained to.
He was the good shot.
He was the hunter,
right?
And it was his dogs,
right?
And so,
but you were not killing the muskoxen.
No,
no.
It was we used two dogs, his dogs, and at the camp, the tent camp, we kept the dogs chained up and fed them food that we'd bought for them, and.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we go out, we took the dogs on chain leashes, and the two dogs, so that they weren't running free, and we would hike across the terrain until we saw a group of muskoxen we thought we could work with. So then we try to do all this without exposing ourselves to the muskoxen, and then we'd try to sneak as close as we could get with controlling the dogs. And then when we got as close as we could get, or if they started moving before and saw us, we would release the dogs. The dogs would run like hell. And the muskoxen would find, they like to go up on a little knoll
mm-hmm.
to form a circle. So they would run up and get a knoll and any high ground, even if it was just slightly. And they formed their circle with the calves in the center. And they put their butts right together, touching
right.
one another. And so then we'd go up, and when the dogs got them localized and were rushing around barking, then we would go in and carefully, and you could call off the dogs. They were trained to be called off, and we put them back on their leash. And, not until, though, the hunter got up close.
Mm-hmm.
So this made it safe for the hunter to go, because muskoxen were focused on the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And the hunter could get fairly close because they're shooting a dart, and you can't be too far away. It's only going to go so far. And you want it to have enough power to hit and release the
dog. Yeah, muskox have that thick.
And you had to be careful that you hit in the rump or someplace where there's a lot of muscle tissue and not a bone close to the surface. And
muskox have all that fur and thick hide.
And it's thinner over their rump. And so you want to hit them, be very specific. And this guy was he knew what to do, and he had a belt with different charges marked in the... that he knew, he'd learned, with different charges. So if it was a big one, he used a greater syringe with greater amount of drug in it. If it was a young one or smaller one, but we didn't mess with the calves at all.
Right.
So then, when if you had, say, five to seven adults in a group with, say, three calves, then we had to be, you know, really careful there. And as soon as he would dart all of the adults.
Wow.
And by that I mean on the non-calves, but the calves, who didn't dart them. And they would go down sequentially, but they would stay right there. The others that were not darted, they wouldn't go away, because here were the animals all together, and they stayed together. And then finally had all the adults down. And then we rushed in and got the dogs in, so the dogs wouldn't go in and bite them. And, and then we'd tie the dogs down to a rock or something with their chains and away, and then from there. And then we'd go in there, and the vet would immediately getting blood samples, mm-hmm. and we would collect some Kibiut a little bit, but we put on the ear tags. But we had to be fast, because you shouldn't have these animals down without breathing for ruminants like that. And they had to be sure that they're all laying in a position that they weren't going to get draining of the guts up into their throat, which would kill them probably in the long run. So we were rushing around doing this thing and getting the ear tags on, but we always stayed together and worked around, so the mm-hmm. calves would stay on the opposite side of the group that was down on the ground. And then, because we didn't want to scare the calves away, because then they may become orphaned calves not rejoin properly and try to join up with other groups and where there was no mom. And so at any rate, while I was there, we marked another 30 animals. We did kill one female that we had. The first one went in, and we thought it had hit a bone, because the animal didn't go down, and they gave it another charge, and maybe it worked its way out of the bone and released the drug so that it got an overdose and it died.
But you had dinner.
Pardon?
You had dinner because of that.
We did. And the dogs did. And we learned a lot from it, because we skinned it and could see how the fat was distributed at that time of the year.
So what else did you learn about?
I should say that just before I'd gotten there, they had marked some, and it was working. And that's when one of these dogs was a younger one, was a little too eager, and it rushed in there when it was holding and got hooked by a adult muskoxen and thrown through the air.
Oh, yeah.
And it went,
you've told me that before.
Yeah, and the guts all spilled out, you know. They gathered it up, and the veterinarian put some sulfa drugs into there to try to eliminate any infections, and sewed it up. They took it back to the camp and tied it up there, and they had to get another one flown out so that you'd have two dogs. And finally, it recovered fine. And they took it back to the village and was able to use it again for hunting and sled pulling.
Yeah, what if that dog wanted to ever go near a muskox again?
But then after we had them marked, then we would did some observations of them where they couldn't see us from ridges and areas where we could view where they were going to be doing the seismic work. And so we had close contact with one of the women, a very nice woman who was working in charge of these environmental studies. And we knew well. I'd known her from the other studies. And so she would sometimes get helicoptered in from the Amoco camp. And while we were getting everything's organized, and that was terrific. She was a beautiful woman, Danish woman, and very intelligent. And so in the camp, you know, the helicopter pilots loved to fly her. And so she came flying in with this helicopter pilot, and we had, that day we had discovered that when some hiking, there was a flush of mushrooms that were growing on the roots of willows, and they were edible. One of the edible mushrooms. And so we gathered up a few, and she came in with the pilot, and we were in this little tent and squeezed in there, and said, "We've got all these nice mushrooms which we're going to hook up, and can come back with and get a hitch back and have dinner with us?" And she said, "Well, I don't know." And the pilot said, "Oh, I think we could probably organize that." But he was working under other orders. So then she came back in the evening, and we had a little gas stove, you know, for cooking.
Right.
But we all squeezed into it, and it was kind of foggy then and miserable out, cool outside. So this was fine. We're all in the tent, and this young pilot who was Canadian, he was Canadian, and the company that was flying the helicopters apparently was Canadian. Mm-hmm. He was a nice young guy, and he was just loved this whole operation. And so here we are with this beautiful Danish woman, and she was able to, with some encouragement from this helicopter pilot, get a already cooked roast beef.
Wow.
And brought that out. And so we had this luxurious meal there, and she joined us, and then she got helicoptered back and to spend the night in the deal. So at any rate, we coordinated when they were going to do the seismic work, and of course it had to be when it couldn't be super foggy, which it sometimes was, because we had to see the animals. And we were up on a ridgetop far away, but with the spotting scopes we could see them closely and read numbers and stuff. And then they had set these things off, and then they could fire them remotely.
The seismic things?
Yeah, the explosion. Mm-hmm. They could. So they did that, and I got big pictures, and the puff of dirt went flying in the air. Mm-hmm. And from a distance it looked, and we could hear the bang, and hardly, the muskoxen hardly, I mean, they looked over it. And there was, the explosion was only a couple hundred yards away from where they were. Hmm. And they looked that direction, and the dust settled, and they just went on feeding. So it didn't
bother them.
It didn't bother them.
Now, is that perhaps because it's a population that's used to being hunted, so the sounds don't bother them? Is it a similar sound?
No, we observed other unmarked groups too. And that wasn't the only one where they were doing the seismic work.
Mm-hmm.
Or we sometimes broke up into two groups, and other groups reacted about the same way.
Oh.
And that makes sense, because if you're in close to the, there were glaciers, you have these big icebergs that would crack, and you'd hear this crash, and that was just part of the sounds of the environment. And unless you see something that you're moving that you can associate with that, and the same with studies on the North Slope with the caribou, in the gas line, for example, you know, what would the pumping station with a gas line, the sound of this thing going? And so they simulated it up there. I wasn't involved in that study. That was done through a consulting firm. And they took movies of the caribou moving through the area in migration. And some of that was in the Arctic Refuge, or it was close to Arctic Village. And the caribou was a continuous sound like that. It was like a waterfall or something. They just came on through, and it was, there was a box that it was coming out of, but they didn't pay attention to it because there's no movement. Hmm. Whereas on the oil field, we saw the same thing too, that oil well, while they're drilling it, there's a horrible noise of the diesel engine, and bang, bang, and as long as there was no movement on the pad, like vehicles moving around or people walking around out on the pad, caribou would be feeding through the area or lying down and resting, and they wouldn't pay any attention to this. They wouldn't avoid this sound. They would avoid it if there was any movement of people or vehicles. And we found the same with the Hall Road and the pipeline in general. It was activity of people. And when we saw other things that, like the Hall Road, they were wolves were killing more animals close to the Hall Road than away from it. So the wolves were not disturbed by the vehicles. Of course, they were, some of them were being fed. But then this is what Dan Roby was getting information on. The wolves would, where the Hall Road was elevated, and especially if it was a slight hill, you couldn't see across the side. So if there were animals on one side, they couldn't see the animals on the other side. And the wolves, when they're hunting, they would not go on the hunt on the road surface necessarily. They would be hunting, and then they would come to a place where there might be caribou on other side of the road. And if you're in way up high in an airplane or helicopter, you could see this. And there was some of this observed from the air as well, that the wolves would sneak up and use the road as a platform very cautiously to look over and see if there were any caribou laying down on the other side. And of course, for killing caribou, if you can make a rush from and get them when they're just getting up, you can kill, can reach them. But if they have a chance to run, the whole strategy of caribou is be in groups, being in open terrain, and then move out before wolves can get close enough to actually make an attack, a successful attack. And so we're seeing this kind of stuff. And it's like the studies too showed that the what was deflecting the caribou up there frequently, other than the pipeline and Hall Road, was riparian shrubs along the rivers. And caribou would be moving and want to go through that. The bulls would usually go right through without much bother. But females with young calves were cautious, and
they knew something was hiding in the bushes.
Nobody wanted to, none of them wanted to be the leaders of that. And finally, you know, the whole group would wanted to get across, and they'd move rapidly through, much more rapidly than the males. They wouldn't stop to feed on the new leaves of willows, which are good foraging.
Well, no, they know something could be hiding there in those
exactly,
bushes.
Exactly, exactly. Right. So then they'd get through, and then they'd settle down when they got on the other side. So there were a lot of things like that that were collected incidental to all of these studies, and collectively was important. But, you know, it ain't that simple as what when you have to deal with the oil industry, and they don't have a clue about ecology and behavior of animals.
So that these musk oxen in Greenland, who were not bothered by the seismic explosion noises, that gave Amoco the go-ahead to just do what they were doing?
Sort of. There was also a lot of geese in some of the wetland areas there, and they were during the flightless period when the young geese were still didn't have flight, and the adults are flightless. And you know, what would be the effect on that? I mean, geese could just fly away normally, and but if they got young, they can't. That can't fly. They can't fly away, and the adults, when they're flightless, and the young can't fly away. So they did some similar studies, and that the geese were more disturbed by the deal than musk oxen, and it maybe we didn't have the history on whether they had been hunted. The geese had been hunted before they arrived there in their migration.
Okay, we're back.
So it's, there were some interesting things that I should mention too. One is, this was when I did, during, I think it was Reagan administration. And so my way was going to be paid to go over there. So it wasn't as if you know, I had to use U.S. money. But my salary, of course, was I was working for the Fish and Wildlife Service. So you're required to get approval for foreign travel. I had to go through the Secretary of the Interior, I think. And so I had to submit this. I talked to my supervisor in Washington, and he said, yeah, that shouldn't be a problem since this, we're not having to foot the bill, and it'll be it's your area of expertise, and this is great. And it's especially it's another country. He was a good guy and appreciated that value of working internationally and in science. And so surprisingly the thing was rejected. My travel was rejected or that could not be approved until I explained what would be the benefits to the United States. And so I quickly talking with the Danes, I said, you know, it's obvious. I mean, it's an American company, oil company. If they find oil, the United States would be beneficiaries of getting oil, market for their oil, but else they would, foreign oil that they could depend on. And so they sent that in, and oh, they bought into that right away, approved it. And then finally, when the letter came authorizing travel, unbelievable. There was a standard letter that warned you about working in a socialist country. I couldn't believe it. And Denmark was a socialist country. And they, that, you know, that you have to be careful, you know, the sort of implied that you could be brainwashed. I mean, it was just stupid mentality at that time.
That was the Reagan
administration.
Do you still have that letter somewhere in your files? That would be fun.
I might. To read. I hope I do, but I haven't gone through all those old files.
No.
That was amazing.
And so, did you do other work in Greenland?
Yeah.
What else did
this
you do?
This was just sort of the beginning. And then, I did that. And then, then we had the International Arctic Angler Conference in Greenland in Nuuk, and I was able to get several of my students over, and that was terrific because we went to Copenhagen and we stayed. That veterinarian was a great guy. He was sort of a freelance veterinarian.
He was a Danish vet.
Yeah, but he had bought. He had been married and then divorced, and he had a son that he raised, and he had bought this old house, beautiful mansion-like house on an island in a lake in Copenhagen. But it was like, who would want to live on an island? Because how do you get and work? It was right, if you could get to the other side up to a shore, that was right on the tram line.
Right.
But what happens when it's freezing up and not frozen up and stuff? They were just amazing guy, and he and his, they kept a little boat with an outboard. At the, they could dock it right there by the train station, and he worked in town, and the boy went to school, and they could go in together, and then they'd meet up and go back in the boat. But what about when the ice is freezing up? When it's solid, in some years it would never be solid, but in most years it would be. Well, then it's not a problem. You just ski across to the landing and or walk across on the ice. And but when it's freezing and breaking up, that's dangerous as hell. No, they found techniques. One of them was got these long poles, and then you put use them like skis, and you could go across this thin ice when it's just freezing up. And you spread your weight over such a vast area, it would work fine. And they would do it together and taught the kids, and both of them was, learned how to do this safely, and they never had any problems. But this, they started renovating this house. It was a mansion, but it was a beautiful place. And it had, they had ducks and geese and chickens on there, free ranging. And and they had goats at one time, and it was just such a pristine place. And so when we went to Greenland, we had a couple of days to lay over there in Denmark, and he volunteered and said, well, when we can give you cheap housing out there, you won't have to pay anything, and we'll try to rig up some way. If you can chip in a little bit for the food, we can... And he had another girlfriend who was a good cook. And so they would put together in this old-fashioned kitchen with a big stove and everything, put back this fabulous meal. And of course, they had lots of... and we could stay there. You know. And we had brought sleeping bags anyway because we were going to be camping out after the on an excursion after the Greenland thing. So it was great, and... they had plenty of Danish beer and maybe even a little akavit and wonderful food and a terrific party that one night. That was great.
And so other biological work in Greenland, more muskox?
Yep. Then I was becoming interested in the high Arctic and the ecology of the high Arctic, especially in northeast Greenland, where there were complete guilds of herbivores, and had been at least, there were muskox and had been caribou, and up until 500 years, and wolves moving in and out from Greenland, from Canada, and there were Arctic foxes, there were lemmings that cycled. There were weasels that were based mainly on the lemmings, and there were birds of prey. And in that North Greenland, there were ptarmigan that migrated out to the south during the darkest part of the winter, but they had come back, and they were the same species as ones south, but they were different. Genetically, they had huge, huge breast muscles, so they're much stronger flyers because they had to fly long distance to south or central or south Greenland, where they would winter, and they But they'd come back, and it would be still be winter. There's snow thawing, and you know they would scatter over the landscape, pecking little buds and stuff, and things that would be sticking through the snow. And they were adapted to doing all this, and they weren't overabundant. And Arctic hares, and I was getting interested in all of these resident herbivores, and especially the hares, lemmings, and muskox, and the mammals, all dependent on vegetation. And how did they possibly do this when there was so? It was classified by botanists as a polar barrens, because it was not covered by ice because it was so dry. And on the other hand, you know, the winters were long, but any snow that fell got blown around into drifts, and that was mainly what fed the green things. And then you had the sun like this 24 hours a day in the short summer, and the plants grew like mad, but they had to start from not much. And so it was fascinating with me, and so I teamed up with this botanist, Christian Bay, who had been doing some vegetation. He was working on his doctorate on the vegetation of North Greenland. And so we went in, and his mentor had started him on that, who I knew and had done a lot of work throughout Greenland. They're both with the Botanical Museum in Copenhagen, which later becomes directly tied to the university, but where they have a fabulous botanical garden in a park right in the city. It's quite nice.
How do you spell his last name? It's Christian
Bay, B-A-Y.
Okay.
Bay, I think it's pronounced that way. So we worked together in 1987, and to work up there is a real expedition. He took responsibility for organizing all the gear and the food, and in 1987, and they had a slim budget, and I got some NSF money to pay for my travel, and some of that, mainly travel, which was fairly expensive because we had to go up in a twin otter from northern Iceland, and you had to get there by regular airlines, and then the twin otter, we shared that cost for the twin otter with another expedition of Danes and one Greenlandic guy that were. They were sort of historians. They were a team of one. There was one writer, a Danish writer, a senior guy. The guy who headed it up was in the Danish, had been in the Danish military, an officer, and he was trying to find the last cairns where a team of Danish explorers dropped off with dog teams and from a sailing ship, and they didn't get back to the ship in time, so they had to over summer in North Greenland, and weren't too concerned about oversummering because they're muskoxen, but they had to feed their dogs and then wait for winter to come again, and then go to the pickup point where there was a supply of food, and wait for another sailing ship to come in the next ring. And they didn't show up. And when ship came there to see whether they made it, the one native guy, his body was there, he had frozen to death. And he'd gotten there, but just barely. And he had to abandon the other two guys who were infirm. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to find these cairns with all this information that they had, and never found these. And so this team was trying to relocate those. So Oh, we split the charter, and then the first half we were in a different place than they were. And then we went back to the Station Nord, where was a base for the Twin Otter. And then we joined up with this other team, and they took us to another place called Blasul, which is a little bit further south, but not much. And it was up around 79 degrees north. Where we were the first time was about 82 degrees north.
And how long were you out in the field on these trips? So I didn't ask you about the other ones, but...
About 3 weeks. And then you have to figure travel time.
Yeah, but on most of these, you're in the field, you're about 3 weeks out on the land.
Well, when we were in the field, there were three of us because they had funding for an assistant. So we had a Danish young guy who was an assistant, and we didn't really need an assistant, but that was paid for, and there wasn't a problem with the Twin Otter getting us out there in a year. And it was a good idea to have somebody out. And he was interested in wolves, but it was... chances of seeing wolf or sign wasn't very good. He came along, and I had a permit to take... It was in the National Park area of Greenland, which sort of, let's say, still allow mining exploration. But we had to have... a permit to kill any animals, so I had a permit to take 10 Arctic hares, and 10, no, I could take, I don't think we needed a permit for the lemmings. They were harder to get. And then we collected poop from all of those animals too, and could differentiate between winter poop and summer poop. So we could take those and poop samples and do an analysis of plant types that were present in the poop. And it was harder to collect poop from summer poop from lemmings because there weren't many visible. And because it's summer is a disaster for the lemmings because you got these birds of prey, the snowy owl and the deer falcon, primarily those two, and then Arctic foxes. Mm-hmm. They were really serious predators for them, and the weasel. Of course, the weasel could go into their burrows and get them. It was a fascinating place to work. And it's fascinating for a lot of reasons, including the geology is all exposed and interesting. And we're trying to get an idea of, you know, things like how could there be, say, 200 muskoxen in this... big valley area, which was a big area, but scattered out into various groups. And we weren't covering the whole area, but we're covering a lot of it. And then frequently there wouldn't be a connection between muskoxen unless a wandering bull wandered through, and especially may have to wander over a glacier, you know, a frozen fjord or something, during the breeding season to spread genes around and keep populations going. So we mapped, we did a lot of measuring of biomass of forage types that we could do with a lot of clipping and small plots with Christian and I, and then we were able to dry and weigh these samples, and take them back for chemical analysis too. And then we also were able to mark where we saw the animals, but that we had that first year we had funding to put three satellite radio collars on. Well, that meant we had to be able to dart three animals. And we wouldn't have dogs with us.
And this was for muskoxen.
Yeah, and so we were doing observations on feeding behavior and group dynamics in relation to feeding, where the group size is larger or smaller. Smaller, we assumed, because there wasn't much vegetation and it was more patchy. So major focus for me was on patch dynamics, how, and I could do that, involve those both the muskoxen as well as hares and the lemmings on this. But the Arctic hares are fascinated too, because they're not ruminants, but they can move over the terrain about like caribou in the wintertime. And they're in groups. That's predator avoidance primarily in the winter, big groups. And so a big group, hard for wolves to make kills because it's so mixed up with the animals running in all different directions. And the lemmings are under the snow, where the snow is drifted. And that's where the willows have enough moisture there to grow the prostrate, one species of prostrate willow, because of the melting snow, especially if it's a south-facing slope, will melt and the water goes down and feeds the sedge meadow below. But then the snow, the willows are one of the earliest leaf out, and the leaves are highest quality forage. And under the snow, the lemmings are eating the twigs of these willows primarily, although they eat almost anything that is left if they're in the peak population. And in the summer, they just try to survive, and they can't be too far from something to eat, but the ideal place is where there's rocks, and they can make burrows under the rocks that wolves or foxes can't dig into. And they take their chances on the weasels, but the weasels are also denning up then, and they usually take over, don't take over, but they take abandoned fox dens, and they use those and do fine. And come visit us in our tents while we're, and they don't have much fear of humans. And
the lemmings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, the weasels.
Oh, the weasels.
Yeah.
Oh.
I guess some good pictures of weasels at their den, and but we'd be cooking or something, and the weasel would come and look, and inside the tent, and then go away. I mean, it was.
They were just curious.
They were just curious, yeah.
Yeah.
At any rate.
So what did that research?
Well, the show. Vegetation work and the patch dynamics and boarding, that went well, because we could do this vegetative work together, and I was also helping Christian find new plant species, and a lot of information on seed dispersal, how do plants get started in the high Arctic, where there's everything north is sea, frozen sea, and these are plants that have to live further south, and then they have to live there. And so it was fascinating. You'd find some of this one species of grass that would come in, and on the old lake bed where the glacier had dammed made the lake, and then it finally washed out. And the lake bed had all this accumulation of sort of clay on bottom and all cracked up, but there was these lush green plants, so the seeds got in there, wind blown probably, and then every musk ox track, you know, come to one nice lush deal about this big of green grass,
6 inches or so,
and take a bite, and then move on to another one, and you see these tracks, and you saw the same thing with goose tracks going, and then what's as good for the plant is they might have, they didn't kill the plant, and then they crap right next to it, and caused both the geese and the muskoxen.
So there's fertilizer.
And then when a muskoxen would die and there were no wolves around, and Arctic foxes could get to the carcass until it froze up, and then they couldn't deal with it. And so they were often just mummified, half decomposed and mummified, and then they would be sticking up over the rocky or gravelly terrain where there would be very little vegetation, and suddenly, now 2 or 3 years later, there's this grass and other thing growing around this. Because they get snow accumulating there, and the seeds are being blown around, and then it's fertilized by the decomposing muskoxen. And if the muskoxen dies in the summertime, I mean, then the flies, there's blowflies there,
right,
and they decompose rapidly, except for the bones. But and if you the bones and you get the skull was laying on the ground in a place where it was mostly rocky and some moss there over that one horn. But those that's all you need for the horns to start decomposing and eventually the bones as well. But if it's dry and cold, it could be there for over 100 years without decomposing.
Well, then interesting that you know. So many people might think of you as a caribou or a reindeer biologist, but here you are doing all this plant work.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, what? I mean, that's the problem. And here, I want to include in the book is that habitat just falls through the cracks. And that's I'm trying to write this
right
opinion piece that so that nobody's employed. And they're not even trained well, because it isn't very popular to be, if you're a wildlife type, you want to work with animals.
Right. The botanists do the plant thing.
Yeah.
But the wildlife people don't look at the plants. So I think it's interesting, like what a glamorous thing you were doing. You're collecting poop and analyzing poop.
And you
what
know,
the glamours of being a wildlife biologist.
One time when Dan Roby and Henning were over there and I was here, and I said I wanted to get some muskox droppings. I think it was winter droppings, or maybe it was summer, I don't remember. And just dry them if it was summer droppings. But technically, you know, you have to have some permit to ship something like that. And so I said, the best thing is to, you know, dry them and get the temperature high enough that it would kill any organism, eggs and things like that. Even though drying would, for a long time, would do the same thing, mostly. And well, you did all that, and then and Dan figured, well, what do we do? How do we label this package? They didn't have a permit to send it. Said there probably isn't going to be a problem in sending a package.
Right.
And it wasn't very heavy. And so I get this package, and the package was about so big, and it was labeled contents bullshit. And it was never, the customs never bothered with it.
Well, it's true. Right, that's what it was.
Yeah. We had a big laugh on that one. They were prepared to try other ones if that didn't work.
Well, that's a good story to perhaps, so we...
That should finish,
okay,
on,
finish.
On the satellite.
Oh, right.
Colors. That, here we were, and it was, and then it cost us, you know, we had some money from National Science Foundation, I think, to cover that, but because we couldn't guarantee we could do this, because the big problem was, how are we going to put these on animals if we don't knock the whole group down? And we weren't prepared to do that. And you have to have dogs anyway if you're going to do that kind of thing. And so we naively thought we could maybe, you know, knock one cow down. We really would prefer to have it on a cow and knock one cow down. But then after watching the animals for a while, and there's no way we can knock a cow down and get handle it and get a collar on, and we had the antagonist to the drug, counter the drug, but you had to have it be able to get to the animal. And if we couldn't get to it because the others were there, and especially bulls, the bulls, or herd bull, we couldn't drug them all, and we didn't have that, and we didn't want this to be a major operation. The main thing was the other stuff. What we wanted was to get radio calls on animals so that in the wintertime, when you can't fly up there anyway, and it's so damn cold, and the muskox can still have to go on eating, where do they go? We didn't have a clue where they went. And and then the worst case scenario was that we were carrying the hunter, this Danish technician. He liked to hunt, and he was killing we had a .22 rifle, I guess, and he was killing hares, and it was a good hunter, and he enjoyed that, and that was good. But he wasn't a good guy to be studying any wildlife, because he was just so superficial. I mean, when I'd want him to be, and we had a hut that we could stay in there, was belonged to the dog team, Danish military dog team patrol. They let us use this hut, and at least a little warmer than outside when it was cooled. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have a lot of cold weather.
You were there in the summertime?
Yeah. But we were there until August when it would freeze, start mm-hmm. freezing at night, and still pretty good weather in the daytime. And then if there was no clouds and no wind, it was usually good temperatures and get up to 75. Now, if there was no wind, suddenly there were like one or two or three mosquitoes. Otherwise, no mosquitoes. So at any rate, this guy that was carrying the gun, he had it. I don't think he had a dart in the gun, but he had the dart in the pack sack, darts, and ready to go. But we had to load them just before. You didn't load them ahead of time. Because this was early on in darting under those conditions. And then there are two things that happened. One was my fault, because I got... my wife at the time's brother wanted to come up and visit, and I don't know if it was a good time from Anchorage. And I said, no, it's the worst time, because I'm going to be just packing up to leave. And I was still building this house up on Gina Ridge. And she told him, oh, it's not a good time. And he said, well, I'll come anyway. And he was that kind of a guy. And I won't bother. But he's one of those guys that had to watch everything you're doing, you know, and if he was around, and ask you all kinds of questions. See, it's naive about the fact that scientists at times have to stick to a rigid schedule and procedure, and how do you do things without, if you take time to answer his questions, how do you keep concentrated on the list that you're working on? So I left behind this little package of the way the darts work. You had a shell that you fired like a 22, mm-hmm. and it propelled this dart. And then inside the dart, when it hit something, it was a little charge that went off, and it squeezed the drug into the animal. Well, that charge that went inside there, that package got left behind. And that was my fault because I hadn't checked everything to be sure. And so then we had to figure out, is there any way we can use this? I had these collars, and we still hadn't tried anything out. I figured, well, I knew the history of these darts a bit that I'd read up on, and I figured that the early darts had a weight in back that was slide. When it hit the animal, it would mm-hmm. slide in like a syringe, and the weight right. would force it in. But you wanted to keep this thing as light as possible because its trajectory with the drug and everything would be short anyway. And so I figured, well, can possibly do something like that because I had some lead. I forget what the lead was for. Like soldering lead. And a coil of that. And so I could take with some pliers, I could cut chunks of that off and make a weight that mm-hmm. would fit inside there and squeeze it because the lead was somewhat malleable. And then it would work, we hoped. So then we decided we got to settle for bowls. Because there are solitary bulls around. We're going to have to settle for bulls. Or even if there are two bulls, I think they wouldn't. One of them would, in shot one, the other one would not stake there because they're not. That's not their behavior. So we were, the first one we were able to get, and we were able to load this thing up and shot, and It didn't go down. And so, fortunately, we were able to get up and get another one in. And then we began to see a little bit of effect. And so my conclusion was it was getting only a small charge was getting into it. So put a little heavier weight and tried to get closer. And then finally it went down. And so when we looked at the darts where it hadn't bounced out or something, and we could see that it wasn't fully discharged. So we were lucky that system worked, but only because we were able to get several shots in. And maybe the first one was enough to, the animal didn't run away. And then we were able to get a second one in a similar kind of situation. And then we had one, and that's how we thought, well, we got the collars on two, and we got one more collar, and then we were going out. Was finding another single animal was not that easy. And I went up, I was doing a long hike by myself and to a place where we'd been once before. It's a flat top, highest mountain in the area, it was a flat top. It wasn't all that high, but it was like 1,500 feet above the surrounding terrain, and you could hike up there very gradually. But when you get up on the top, there was a lot of muskox droppings there. It was a place where these big bulls would go and just hang out because, say, after they fill their guts up in the summertime, and it was mostly summer droppings up there, and here was there was an old horn core of the skull that had been up there for years, and all just the central part, and mm-hmm. and so I picked that up, and I thought, well, I wanted to go up there and check again, so I went up there again by myself without the dart gun, and I got up there, and the reason I got up there, now that I remember, was there was a shed. Shed antler from, and we found like three or four all the time we're up there, and that they could be anywhere from 500 to 7,000 or 8,000 years.
Wow.
And if they're in a dry, rocky area, they would last.
Huh.
And so here were all these droppings, and then I got up there and I came over the top, and well, there's a bull, big bull, muskoxen, laying down, and is looking the other way. I think, oh, I want to get that that antler, and how can I get it without him seeing me? If he does see me, then what do I do? Well, there was a huge boulder that had been left by the receding glacier right up on this. That thing that you could jump up on, and muskoxen probably couldn't get up there. And I'm pretty sure they wouldn't try to get up on. I mean, they're just mostly bluff anyway, but they don't want to risk it.
No.
And so I tried sneaking over there, and just almost there, looked around, and he got up, and I grabbed the antler, and I ran and jumped up on this rock. Well, this muskoxen was not happy. Probably hadn't seen humans before, and it came and made all these bluffs where it rubs its foot. Puts its foot down on a tussock or a rock, and puts his head down and rubs his gland right mm-hmm. here.
Under their eye?
Yeah.
Or on their cheek?
Yeah, and it doesn't smell strong, but it's an important smell for them. And they rub that on the hoof, and then sometimes they'll stamp their foot a little bit. And then I've just seen this happen up in the North Slope. Most of the time you figure that's just stand your ground, don't run, and just bluff the creature and mm-hmm. wave your arms and stand up straight. And we did that when Christian and I were out picking vegetation, mm-hmm. and there would become this bull. And that's the beginning of the rutting season, so they're looking for anything that moves, that's big. It might be a cow. And usually when we'd see one and it was wide open, well, could we move quickly into a drainage ditch and then move laterally so it wouldn't see where we're going, and then keep an eye on it, because if they don't see anything, they're not going to come. And that worked two or three times for us okay. And then one time we just had to stand up together and separated it a little bit and wave our arms and eventually decided it didn't look very appealing to it. Muskoxen. At any rate, so then after I got back up on this rock,
right.
It came and even butted the rock.
Wow.
And so I took there was a couple of smaller stones up on top there, and I could drop that down there, and it would just make it angry. And I'd just drop it on it. So I figured, well, I'll try to get over on the on the blind side of the rock so it couldn't see me and see what happens. And, well, I did that, but it just stayed right there. And I thought, when I came, called back up again. Of course, I was eager to get off and head back. And I said, the main thing is to just get over the edge of this flat top deal. And so I just stayed right there by the rock. And so I did finally slide down on the backside quietly and walk very slowly. And my last glance I could see was it was still laying, looking in the other direction. Couldn't see me if I kept the rock between me and it. And I went over the edge and then went back. So then I said, okay, to the other guys, let's go back up there. It was like about a 3-mile hike. I said, let's go back and see if we can get that wool or the third color. So we went back. We get up there before we get up, went up to the top, I said, well, we better load up here. And the guy had lost the bolt, had fallen out of the thing.
Uh-oh.
So we had no way of firing anything. We went up, and the muskox had gone down some big boulders where we probably could have gotten close. But there's no way we would find that. We looked, and we didn't know where. He didn't know where it had fallen out.
So it was the bolt from the gun or from the...
From the gun.
Okay.
So we couldn't have any alternative to dart the animals. So at any rate, we only got two out, which under the circumstances was pretty
good. Sounds pretty good under the circumstances.
And then it did. Two of them lasted for... They had batteries that were supposed to last about 2 years, I think. And one of them lasted about 8 months, and the other one was still functional. And so we were able to get downloaded from that satellite showing where they had wintered, because it gave your location every day, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Once a day, maybe it was twice. The more frequently, the less strength along the batteries would last. And then Christian, by this time, had been able to get some satellite imagery of vegetation. He learned how to ground truth it and make a map of the vegetation in the study area, showing that where they were going was one of the richest places for willows in the whole north area of Greenland. And that the two had moved. One of them had stayed there until the battery ran out, and then the other one had moved to another patch, which was also another isolated patch of vegetation. So they didn't tell us whether the female and young were doing the same thing, which is likely, but at least we had this information that these animals had to feed all winter long, and they could do it and survive up there at the northernmost land area in the world. And that was great. I could
That's pretty exciting.
Included that in a publication on that and the patch dynamics, and it was a major publication. And then I did. Then I got up there again in 1992, and we went to a different area which had more muskoxen. That was the area where there was about 200 in this huge two valleys with a fjord on either side, and it was protected with high mountains from the influence of the frozen Arctic Ocean, so that it was sort of like an oasis that wouldn't have the cold winds coming off the ice, and the mountains would absorb heat, dark rock, in the daytime, and radiate it. So in the springtime, so that the plants would go on, start growing long before they could in other areas. So it was, and then we were able to collect hares there and lemmings and look at, got length and contact and relationship to snowshoe hares mainly snowshoe hares, showing how the guts were longer and allowed for cica, which they do some fermentation in the lower gut. Hares do, as well as geese and horses that aren't ruminants, and helps digest food. And also did some gut length on the and morphology of wild hares through the morphology on lemmings as well. And then we had the feces we could analyze to see what basically confirm what we assumed was the case and what they're feeding on. Mm-hmm. So now I was into the ecology of high Arctic vertebrate ecosystems, including the migratory birds and the ptarmigan, which were also feeding on many of the same plants the hares were feeding on, and lemmings and muskoxen. So that was one of the best papers. And then they started this research station at a place called Zakenberg at 75 degrees north in northeast Greenland. And Henning was now with the Polar Center, Danish Polar Center, and he was one of the key players getting overseeing the actual planning and design and physical structures or infrastructure for the research station, as well as doing some research himself. But now he was really good with electronics, and he was able to set up these remote sensing cameras on this one mountain that could watch the landscape when no one was there all winter mm-hmm. long, and see how the snow accumulated and how it melted off. And that was a new advantage for Arctic work. And then when they were there, they had a cook and biologists from studying all kinds of things there, and I was working mainly with the muskox and lemmings and vegetation. And then my focus was mainly on secondary chemicals and how that affected the how do these plants survive when they're primary food for these herbivores? How can the willows, one species of willows that all prostrate, that are fed on, very all important for the lemmings and the hares and the muskoxen, for hares and muskoxen, their primary value was when they're just leafing out. But they would be eaten. The twigs that were exposed and not covered with deep snow and drifts would be eaten. Twigs would be eaten by hares and muskoxen. And if it was under the snow, the willows under the snow, then it was the lemmings. And they would be fairly secure then under the snow, and they breed under the snow, and population could increase, and suddenly in the late winter, the lemmings all
they
over
all
the place.
Come out of the snow, yeah.
Yeah.
So when did you do that Zakenberg research station? What year was that project?
That was 2000.
Okay.
And that was great, and I was having some hip problems. So, I mean, I could still hike, but it was long hikes like I could do in the other places. I could do, I had to do them so damn slow. But mostly we were able to hike to the areas. And then I had one grad student with me, Fiona Danks, who did some work for her master's on North Slope and worked really based on what she learned working with Christian and me, but Christian on the vegetation and remote sensing. So she was able to, and her interest was more in landforms and geography in relationship to animal distribution. So she was interested in remote sensing. And so the three of us worked together picking willow leaves and comparing male plants versus female plants. And so then when they finally did a 10-year summary of research at the Zuckerman Station, we had a major contribution to one chapter. I was a co-author, and that dealt with willows and secondary chemicals and how they differed in the female versus male plants. And there have been a little research getting started in Canada on this, and so we could build on that and do our own and show that the male plants and female plants were so different. It was like this is a kind of the reverse of what the human sexual difference is. The female plants were more robust and maintained the secondary chemicals but they grow fast, much faster than the male plants. Male plants tended to be located and germinate on little bumps, and if you had the high center polygons, they would be in the high places where it tends to suffer from summer drought. But it was the first place where plants could start to grow, whereas the females were down a little lower on the terrain. But lower, right next to other, really. And and it all fits with the male plant has to produce this pollen. And so they have in the buds going into the winter, and then they have this growth spurt and produces pollen. So the pollen is there, and the female plants, all they have to do is produce floral parts, and then their big job is nurturing the developing embryos, the seeds, whereas the male plant is all over as soon as it pollinates and drops off these catkins, whereas the females hold on to these and they become the seed pods that eventually will open up. But the stems, the flowering stems of the female plants have more surface area and bigger leaves than the male plants for their catkins. And the male plants are designed more to prevent their being browsed in the wintertime by lemmings, maybe, and under the snow. And then the female plants are... Their effort is focused on getting those seeds out and getting them to develop, and the seeds can germinate the same summer. Although they can overwinter, but they're so tiny they can't last very long if they don't germinate fairly soon. And they're so light they scatter all over the place. But then they have these color changes in the leaves that the pods turn red, almost like that shirt or your heel, and dark. And that absorbs the heat from the sun, and also protects them from most herbivores. because they're going for the green, less green leaves that are have less, they're photosynthesizing hard, that they don't have as high secondary chemicals and not as defensive. So you just grow fast, produce more leaves, and the herbivores can include the caterpillars and of butterflies, which aren't usually that abundant to be significant, but there can be other insects that could be defoliators as well.
So was 2000 then the last trip to Greenland?
Yeah. But not to Denmark. And there's one book.
I was going to say, maybe we save Denmark for another night, because that's a whole nother... I mean, you've already talked about your roe deer.
Yeah, and probably a follow-up in Denmark, because I was involved with this Arctic climate impact assessment, and most of the things then were... So Greenland was a big player in that, as well as Norway, and then to a lesser extent, Sweden and Finland.
Okay, yeah, why don't we save that?
Yep.
Seems like a whole nother topic.
Yep.
So to wrap up then, Greenland, how you have reflected on that work you did there?
Well, one of the things is when I was younger in my career, when I was working in Southeast on deer, PhD work, and working with as a biologist, and then at the university it was with still focusing heavily on big ungulates and Arctic adaptations. But it was low Arctic. And the number of plant, vascular plant species on the North Slope, I think is around 3,000. Up there in North Greenland, there were, we couldn't quite crack 100 species. And like there was like four or five species, which are the ones that were essential for the herbivores.
And so the North Slope isn't considered high Arctic?
No, it's low Arctic. Because you got the Canadian archipelago, and then the North Coast is, what, 70 degrees north, about that?
Of the North Slope? I don't remember what
72, I think it is.
I was going to say 72 or 73, yeah.
And so you're up to 83 degrees in North Greenland. So that's the northernmost land area. Mm-hmm. And you can get almost that far in Canada, but not quite as far as in.
Well, just from listening to you talk about all the work you did there, and it sounds, as you say, you were fascinated with it and you really enjoyed Greenland and Iceland.
Fascinated with, for a lot of reasons, but, you know, one is just like St. Matthew Island, it's a remote place, it's hard to get to. So there's a lot to be learned. Mm-hmm. And plus, I became more and more interested, I became more broader, and I was the same through here. I mean, I used to be pretty focused on caribou and deer in Southeast, and then I moved up here. Well, it was caribou was the main focus, and people, you know, called me caribou biologist, and I didn't really feel like I was a caribou biologist. And plus, I realized, and people called me an ecologist, and I said, well, I'd like to be considered an ecologist, but I didn't consider myself an ecologist because I didn't understand all of these interactions that are going on. In other words, ecology is so complex, yet I was trained in ecology as an undergraduate, and I understood terminally. And the problem now is, and this doesn't have to be recorded, it can be.
Go ahead. The problem now is?
Is that young people have new methodologies that are, we didn't have, that are all important, like DNA. And you can answer so many questions with DNA, and like fish migration and caribou relationship between different herds, how much exchange is there and how many years is to account for them to be slightly different. Every animal is different, but genetically, but you can do so much with DNA. Studies you can determine, you know, how much interbreeding there'd been with reindeer and things like that, mm-hmm. and or between herds, and then you get the satellite collars and things, and that are so small now they're putting them on little tiny migratory birds that fly nonstop from Alaska to Australia, and they can plot the route because it's satellite.
Yeah. Well, I would say you're an ecologist based on
I consider myself an ecologist now. But what I'm saying is most people don't pay much attention to ecology. That's the problem with habitat.
Right.
I mean, it's an important part of ecosystems, especially for the herbivores, but also for everything else that's dependent upon the herbivores. And if you have to factor in all of these other things that you don't, like insects. And insects here, as defoliators, can be really important. And so what about the red squirrel? You know, well, as an ecologist, you got to think, their populations fluctuate in relationship to seed production. If humans aren't feeding them sunflower right. seeds in their feeder, they have to, and they want white spruce. In starvation situation, they'll eat black spruce, but it takes them so long, and the seeds are so small, they're top quality, but the amount of energy and nutrients you get with the amount of work you put in, it's a losing battle. It may prevent starvation, but all winter long, it's not going to work. And then we had the spruce budworm mm-hmm. that attack the flowering part of the buds of the spruce, the white spruce. So they couldn't produce any seeds. And white spruce is survival for the flying squirrels through the winter. So they couldn't cache. So what did they do? Well, they could go and excavate and find cones in their middens that they had missed. Well, that works for 1 or 2 years, but and you can't have a lot of squirrels doing this. And then you fight to find a cache that is defended by another male. Maybe you can beat him up and get it, but chances are good you can't. And then we don't know enough about female red squirrels with young. Chances are they can stay and use the same cache that the male was using. But normally in the wintertime, there's only one squirrel per cache. What happens to the young? Well, the dispersal into areas where there aren't enough squirrels and there's still food. And, well, after the population is low and it's coming up, well, that will work. But we don't, there's all these things we don't know.
It just shows how complicated the ecosystems are.
Exactly.
And how being an ecologist requires very broad thinking and looking at all
it's
those variables.
It's sort of like, when this Molly was interviewing me, she's pretty knowledgeable biologically, but she isn't trained as a biologist. But I was trying to explain complexity of a system, and I hadn't mentioned ecology. And she said, oh, that's ecology. I said, yeah, that's right. But most people don't understand that.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, there are all these variables, and so as a non-scientist, it's hard to imagine how can you ever figure out
right. What's
going on, because there's always some other variable that you have to go investigate.
Yeah, we talked a bit about modeling too.
Yeah. And you'll never get the answers, it feels like.
Right.
But you guys, you keep plugging away at trying to figure out the answers.
Well, we haven't discussed modeling very much.
No, we'll talk about that another. That's another part of the difference in methodology.
Yeah, right.
How that's
because
changed.
We should talk about that because
okay.
I've been sort of a real critic of modeling and biological modeling of systems, mm-hmm. complex systems, and So I, but on the other hand, like, well, we'll save it for the next time.
Yeah, we'll save it for the next time. Okay. Yeah. Say goodnight, Gracie.